to Black Women Are Scary, the podcast that celebrates people of color writing horror. Our featured author for our final Friday episode is Shweta Taneja, who we spoke with over the summer about everything from how to handle catcalling to why she loves dolphins. So let's lean in and listen to some scary women. Back, like, when do people start really trying to say my name right?
I think it's recent, because in the last 10 years, whenever I've interacted with people not from my culture, because I'm based in India, so mostly I've been interacting with Indians who kind of know how to pronounce this name. There have been, questions to me also, where people have asked me, can I say something else for your name? It's so difficult to pronounce, which is true. I kind of understand, but I also feel that comes from a place of power and privilege, when people can assume that yours is the exotic name rather than theirs. Right. And most of them have been white skinned, the ones who have assumed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can actually say, after Barack Obama became president, at least I noted it in my country.
That's wonderful.
Because I was living abroad for a while. Yeah. And before I left, he was inaugurated, and then shortly after, it wasn't because he was inaugurated, I left because I was just traveling. But that's why I noted it, because I was actually living outside of the United States around and in international spaces where nobody was really asking me that question, because everybody had a name. People had to ask, like, how do you say that correctly, right? Like, I was working in, like, international schools, so folks were like, that was just part of their practice.
Yeah.
And just in life. So it was like, when I was living in the States, you know, then he became president, and then I came back towards, like, the end of his second term, and I noticed that nobody asked me that, and no one said, can I get a nickname, or these questions that I was used to getting.
Yeah.
Just stopped, and people were starting to get my name on the first try, which wasn't the case before. Like, people also didn't try before. Like, they would hear it and they would automatically just be like, I can't say that. And now suddenly they were like, they would just say it right back. And it was there was nothing. That's not a big deal. And I'm like, I really think it's because all of you had to say Barack Hussein Obama for 8 years and you all got over it. Like, you were like, I could say
I never thought of it that way, but yeah, you're so right. It makes a huge difference, right? When power is given to different names, really, even that much.
Yeah, I mean, that was the president of the United States, right?
Yeah, so
like, exactly. Everybody was like, sometimes people have different names, I guess. I don't even think it was conscious. And for me, it's not always, like you said, like a position of power and privilege. It wasn't even always folks you would think are privileged that would respond that way to my name.
Oh, I see.
It was, so it's just kind of, it does also becomes like, I don't know, it gets even more complicated. I'm not sure if you've had that where other people of color are just like, I can't say a name, or can I get a nickname, or something like that.
Not that often. I kind of sneak into circles where I'm accepted, I think.
Good.
And
for
I enjoy
you.
Being with people who, like, had, like, you know, diverse experiences rather than have had I think it's a subconscious thing, but now that I think about it, perhaps that's the reason. Maybe not enough exposure in my case.
So I don't know, that was a tangent in a way, but I like when things get off into tangents. Two people with difficult names, or
different names.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Vimoto, what's your story? How did you start this podcast? I was very curious to know how you got into it. I haven't researched on the podcast much, so actually just wanted to know how you got into it and how it's working out for you.
I mean, it's working out really well. And I got into it ultimately just to find my tribe. So it was during the pandemic, and I was just like, I know I'm not the only brown or black lady who writes horror and sci-fi and loves it. And I know there's more than just like, the heavy hit. I mean, of course, N.K. Jemisin, Octavia, Butler, all these people's books. I'm like, but who's doing things? Who's out there just like making horror stories, trying to get them, just writing shorts or novels and trying to get them published? Like, where are my colleagues? Where's my cohort? Right. So it was really just like, this is an excuse to just find my tribe. Like, who else is out there? Like, I just want to hang out. I want to talk to these people. How can I do
I
this?
totally get that.
And how can I also like shine a light on us and uplift us and give everybody their flowers? So that was really where it came from. Of it was kind of selfish in that way of just like, where's my community? And then it ended up just being like, it's still just like a whole lot of fun. I get to read cool things and work with, independent publishers and meet great authors and tell great story. I mean, like it's just great.
Yeah, fabulous.
So
That's
that's kind of how it happens. And like, we were doing like a story a month when we started. Like it's really small. Like now we're up to like three episodes where it's like one story and then a flash fiction episode. And then this final
awesome.
Friday with you, with the authors to like so people can just get to know the work. So it's like every month there's a different author featured and people can get to know you and your stories and your work and where to find out about more of what you do. And hopefully like you get new fans, right? Like that's my hope is that people come to this podcast when they're like, who I want to know about this and I don't know where to look. And Black Women Are Scary is like a hub for folks. Make it easy.
Well, yeah, fabulous. That's quite productive of you also in a way. Like, I've always wanted to hang out with people but never like figured out a channel on how to do chat. I'm quite chatting. I love talking. I love exchanging stories from each other's worlds, but
Yeah.
yeah, a little lazy as well.
It's
Like to
also,
be circle and
yeah.
well, yeah.
It's
It
also really hard. Like even if you
is,
weren't lazy,
it's a lot of work,
it's
which
like
is why, yeah.
where do you go? And then there's a finite amount of spaces for folks like us. And then it's also like socializing is hard. And it's scary. Like people are scary. Like how you can't be sure if it's gonna be like a sa like a, I don't know, a safe space is kind of a I don't know like buzzwords, but you don't know if it's gonna be a space of reciprocity.
But have you had that experience so far in interviews or in interaction with other authors, so to speak?
I mean,
Yeah.
mostly everybody's like, you want to produce. You care about my story. I mean, authors are like, you read my story and you care and you care about it. Yay. Because you never know. Like you write these things and you put them out into the world and you're like, I don't know if anybody looked at this and if anybody cares. So I think having someone reach out and be like, I care, is fun times. Like who's gonna be like boo to that?
Yeah, especially short stories because so few people actually reach out back to you in terms of feedback or just readers letting you know that short stories that you have sent out in the world have done have connected with them in certain ways. Or yeah, it's quite valuable that kind of email that it happens when it happens or message or something. Usually it's an email for me.
I feel like this is a good segue to talk about your short story. So I remember in one of our email correspondences, you mentioned that this was based in a kind of Indian storytelling tradition where people do things in a group or a chorus. And I just wanted to know a little bit more about this tradition. And is it just for any story or certain types of stories?
Yeah, so I think let me start with like my a personal story, so to speak. So there is a very strong oral storytelling tradition in India. But my personal memory, which kind of feeds into this this narrative that I've built in this story, comes from my grandmother, my mother's mother, who would sit when it was like really raining outside. She would sit with me in the balcony in my house and tell me stories. And these stories would usually be fantastical stories of kings and queens, of princesses, and there would be all kind of mythical creatures as well in that. Sometimes a little dark, sometimes with a little moral at the end of it, mostly with a little moral at the end of it, really. And I grew up in that kind of a oral storytelling tradition, whether it was taking in from my elders those stories, or just making up stories and sitting with like a bunch of my cousins in a circle and just telling them scary stories when electricity would go off in our house. You know? So I think the whole storytelling has been very oral in my head rather than a written form where you kind of hide behind a book. That also happened, but that happened on parallel with this oral storytelling where we are connecting, we are telling each other stories. And then there are these few festivals where there are like a group of women who sit together and sing a story. So it's like a singing kind of entertaining festival where they're also learning from each other, but they're retelling this story together. And so some of them would improvise on the same story. Everyone knows that basic story, you know, but everyone will add a little like a little different tune to the song, or a little episode which was never there, and it kind of builds up this mass of story, so to speak. And I think when I grew up, I did my literature, and while reading, I came across the Greek chorus as well, which is again like a bunch of people standing on the side of a Greek tragedy play and reflecting on what is happening, and especially a moralistic stance. And both of these traditions, my own tradition of storytelling and this chorus of women singing these stories, and the Greek kind of tradition kind of merged when I was writing this story. And I was thinking of who is narrating this. So it had to be a group of women who are like singing their story together and telling us what happened to them. And I think it's come out some the way that I would have liked to write it. Yeah.
I have a question about these festivals. So there's like it's like a music festival or it's a storytelling festival or both?
So it's a religious festival, one of the festivals. So there are many, many different festivals. So some would be village festivals where there's a special day, say a special religion day or something, and there's a group of musicians who will come to the village to entertain everyone. So there would be they would have like paintings, hand-drawn paintings, as well as music instruments, and they will sing out the story. So it's a story from Indian mythology, most probably, or of a local warrior and his or her feats and what they did and how they conquered and what happened. And all of these stories, there's like this mass of stories across India, and all of these are interconnected as well. And all of them are individualistic for the village, for the community. So there are many, many festivals like this that keep happening across the country, and there are different stories that you find in different parts of the country that you've never heard before, or different versions of the same story as well. And then the women singing together is another thing that would happen in certain days where it's a women festival, mostly around fertility or marriage or childbearing, or and they would come together and they would sing together and bless each other and celebrate with each other the womanhood that they are. And those stories are different. So it's mostly a moralistic story in that case, where there's a song which they sing together to either bless a new bride in certain festivals, or to just celebrate their womanhood, or to just be there for each other, kind of thing, this kind of community coming together telling stories. Oral storytelling is like so much in our blood that I have to consciously think about it now that you ask
Yeah,
that question.
right.
Yeah.
It just feels like.
Where all does it happen and how does
Yeah,
it come?
because it's just sort of Tuesday for you, but it's rare in other places where you can actually where women can get together and celebrate being a woman or womanhood. There would be time set aside for that. So I thought that that was really interesting when you sort of mentioned that, and I was like, what does that even look like? And I'm imagining, just from my own culture and storytelling traditions, that there's like does it work where there's musicians that just kind of like keep the beat and then people are like riffing and off of one another and off of the music that's there? Or is it all a cappella, or do they have handheld instruments? Like, I've seen it work that way in my community, is, so I'm just wondering, like, how is there, are there people, is there somebody who has like a handheld like gourd or like, like maraca or something like that? They keep the pace going and then everybody just kind of gets to like riff off of it.
So there's bad dancing, if there is any dancing, but
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
there would be
Okay.
some instruments like a percussion instrument. There would be either and a piano kind of a thing. We call it harmonium. Then there would be just like people who would pick up, say, utensils and just play start the beat together. And everyone in that community, everyone who's attending that particular festival will sing together. So mostly it can be like a individual singer who sings and other people respond, or it can be everyone singing together. So this chorus voice, and it's not always very pleasant to listen to because everyone has different, like, tones, and you can be pretty tone deaf. But the energy is there, the energy and the enthusiasm, and somebody's screaming in your ear, or somebody's like, singing very beautifully. But the energy is choral in its texture, so to speak.
Yeah, that all actually makes sense to me. There's many different versions of that, I think, all over the world.
Yeah, I
that,
think
where
so.
that's the case. Like, that was also, we had traditions like that for myself growing up. It was just around different subjects. like it was like the reason for doing it was different. But it's still the same of like either to tell a story about, whether it's a cautionary tale, like don't go in there because La Llorona is gonna get you or something like that, like whether it's things like that or like I guess with people, what would be called, in some circles, like folk music. But also, like, hip hop is very much like that. Hip hop is very, people just like play the pencils on the table, and you just make up, you're just making up stories about what happened that day or what's going on in the community. Like, and that's all coming back from, various musical traditions in all over Africa. So it's kind of iterating off of that in a new world. And amalgamating.
I would love to see that. I haven't yet.
Yeah, to me, it sounds like a cipher, what you're saying, which is that is like, it's like a jam. It's like Black people in America do all the time.
Exactly. That's why when you ask me whether there's special festivals, I'm like, probably any evening where you can find five people.
Right, okay.
There's no reason for it to be a festival here.
Right. It's not like official. It's just like somebody brought out a guitar and we were off. We were telling the stories and we were jamming out. Okay, cool. Then yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking when I was like, does it work the same way in India? And I guess it does. It works the same way. Maybe it's just a very human thing to get together and like someone plays, brings out spoons and it's like, let's do it. So you have this tension, right? And I love it, this tension and terror between these generations in your story, right? You've got mothers just kind of talking about how their children aren't theirs anymore. And just in general, I feel like the whole theme of the story is we did all these things, we thought we were right, and then our kids just went on ahead and did something else, and now we need to catch up. So what inspired you to write this dynamic, this tension between generations?
I think generations is something again which growing up is very important for my culture, because we we have like different generations that stay together in most households, which would not be like, you know, standalone, just a single generation.
Yeah.
It would be children and parents living together with the parents, so to speak. And there are tensions within those generations, but it's also important, that sense of community.
Yeah.
It's breaking down a little bit in cities. Like I live on my own with my husband, but it's something that's very important, talking to different generations and connecting with different generations.
Yeah.
Within the culture that I've grown up in. So I think when I started to think about technology and a disruptive technology that another species would bring into the world, which might in a way be saving the world, but it's super disruptive for anybody who's used to a certain kind of world. I think that definitely brought in the older generation, which is more resistant to change usually, and how they would try to resist or push back on a dramatic change like that, especially if it's not introduced by their own species, but another species. And on the other hand, a more adaptable, younger generation, which might, by choice or without choice, in this case, I think it was likely without choice also, just adapt to the new technology which has come and, you know, have completely changed. And what happens to those who are left behind? And I think that frustration or this resistance in adapting to a new disruptive technology or this future which is not yours anymore. I feel even in today's world, the older generation feels that with, say, cell phones or blockchain. I'm already feeling that with blockchain, for example. I'm like, I don't know how that world's going to change. And I'm not sure how then I can adapt to it. So that's a very smaller, you know, example of what I imagine the mothers to feel, especially when you see your children biologically changing.
Yeah.
And you not connect to that. I mean, that's quite tragic in a way also, that change. Even though it's good for the world, it's tragic for that those mothers, I think, to see that happen to their world. Their world's falling apart, the world that they've known. And to try to connect back to it, it's going to be very hard. I think that's where I was coming from. And these two generations became natural into the story as I wrote them.
Yeah. Yeah, and I feel that that's kind of the conversation that's happening all over, even with, you know, what to do about climate crisis, what to do about the way we live on the planet, and how to be more in tune with living on the planet, right? like right now, we're sort of like living on top of Earth, and we're not like living in Earth, if you will. We're not very integrated. So how do we go about making that shift in a way that that we, you know, that is both good for the planet, but also we, you know,
we're able to do it.
I think we're confronting like some of the things where it's like, yeah, you like this and this is the way it was, but you're gonna have to let it go because it was the way it was, but it was not good even in its inception. Like, it's caused a lot of harm, even if that's not what you meant to do. Like, there's just lots of things that I've had to face in my life too, where it's just like, I really enjoyed, especially when, you know, COVID happened, it was like a hard stop on the life that I was living.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of it where I was like, really happy to let it go. Cause I was like, I actually never liked doing things that way anyway, you know? So there was something that part was easy, but for the other, there's been other things where I'm like, oh, this actually wasn't good for anybody, and it wasn't even really good for me, and as comfortable as it is, I just have to let it go. And it's hard because you're not really sure what you're stepping towards. You don't know what you're stepping into. It's like, now you got to go to the new place. And I think the older you get, the harder, the scarier that is.
Yeah.
Right.
But do you think pandemics changed us, or are we like going back to the pre-pandemic lifestyle that we had, because it was just so comforting as well, in a way, that things we know, things.
I think it's a little bit of both. So I don't think that, I mean, I don't think change really is linear, you know? So I think, but I do feel like there is a divide happening, like a distance. So that is what appealed so much about your story to me is like, oh, I can feel this conversation of the folks who are like, we got to go to the new place. And the people are like, no, let's go back to what we were doing. And it's like, that ship has sailed. It's like, it's done. Like, people either don't want to go back because they're like, actually, I never liked it and I never had a chance to stop and think about it. And now that I have, I'm not going back. And then, even or the folks who are like, yeah, it was comfortable, but 5 years from now, we're not even going to be able to keep doing it. So there's no point, right? Like, there's also like this question of sustainability, which I think runs throughout in your story as well, where it's like these dome cities just they were gonna go down. Like this was gonna happen. This was inevitable. So you also have to change. Like, I think we're at that point in particular with the climate and a lot of these systems that we had going on, where it's like it just doesn't even work the way it used to. It doesn't serve anybody. Everyone is uncomfortable, even if it's familiar. And you really only have like a couple more years before it implodes. So you really, it's like it's a sinking ship. We got to get off of it. And so yeah, I feel both. I feel like the let's go back and the people who are like, no, I want to move forward. And the people who are like, we can't go back because it's not going to work. And then we're going to have this conversation again. And I think that's why it's just like so tense right now.
Yeah, I mean, climate's already like scary.
Yeah.
India seeing like I'm into bird watching, and India seeing birds that they have never seen in seasons that they have no business. Like Antarctica birds should not be here in India. It's too hot for them. But the whole like the whole sea animals have changed, and they're landing up on here when they should be somewhere in the north or south, extreme north or south of
Yeah.
And floods and heat waves, it's like nearly there for everyone, not only for the Asian subcontinent, but yeah, for
Yeah.
everyone.
Everyone in the world is experiencing that. So we're
Yeah,
as
like
was and
fires.
yeah, and I see it in the news. Like it's happening here, and then they're like, so and such and such place is also experiencing record temperatures of this or that. And I'm like, this is scarier. Like it's
Yeah.
for me, and I do think it's kind of where you are in your age. Like if I think if you're of a certain generation where you're not gonna have to see a lot of this, it's a little easier to dismiss, but it's like I'm thinking like I'm gonna be a senior citizen when what? Like when it's how hot, when the what dries up, like I have to, and
Yeah.
anybody younger is like, I'm gonna have to come of age in this. Like I'm gonna have to
Yeah.
somehow raise a family in on water rations. Like I don't actually wanna do this. So it's a little like the sense of urgency is also a bit different.
Yeah. 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 And I think the older generation than you or than me, maybe have already lived their life a certain way, and their priorities are still like keeping that lifestyle, and they would be more resistant to change, and it's scary to change also, like changing that life. It's really scary. Things like war and all really screw people's minds up, dramatic change. I mean, that war brings, not the bloodshed and stuff, just the dramatic change in your lifestyle also. So I think even though we
And
know we have to do it, it's still scary for us to change ourselves in certain extent to that extent.
yeah, I think a lot of it also has to do, and this is what I loved about, your work and the stories in this anthology, The Multispecies, is that, it's just a bunch of forward thinkers really who are just like, well, what does it look like after? Like this horrible thing happens, and then this is how it could be after that. This is what we could, so much in so many of the stories, like take the fear and then go past it. And I think that would help people
And
make
keep the
this change.
optimism. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that would
Yeah.
help
Keep
people make this change. If
the.
somebody, instead of saying, like, we can't do this, we can't do this, talk about what we can't do, talk about what we can do. Like, I think folks would feel less afraid of changing if they knew what they were changing into. But there's not enough focus on, like, where's the destination? Like it's gonna look like this. Like paint the picture and then say we're gonna get there. It's just a lot of like trying to win an argument. And I'm like, that's not gonna, of course people are gonna resist because you're not telling them where you're taking them. You're just like, it can't be like this. Like your way of life just can't happen anymore. And it's like, well, what do you, but where are we gonna go? What do you want us to do?
That's the hard part, right? You don't know what the future will look like if you change today, really.
Yeah. But you
And
can have a vision,
yeah,
right?
I'm towards I'm, in the story, I'm for all for dolphins, like bringing in empathology. I mean, that works for me, really. It'll be terrible for us. I'll probably hate it personally if that happens.
Mm.
But I think it's required for the planet. I'm
Right.
all for that vision, really. But yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, I enjoyed how difficult it was. I enjoyed that you wrote in, one, that it was told from the perspective of mothers, and that they weren't like, oh, just all nurturing and fine with it. Like they fought, they murdered dolphins.
Blue are dolphins, blues are dolphins,
Like, they were like, yes, death to
course
dolphins. How dare you take my baby? Like, that
it
was that,
is.
yeah, that felt real. And then
Yeah.
finally, it's like, you just, they just had to resign.
Yeah, and I think at the end of it was a little positive also. I mean, they went through that dip really, like, of anger and frustration and grief really, and helplessness to accepting that the world's changed around them, and then they would like to be part of the new world as well. I think that's where we leave them in the story. At least that's what my intention was. I don't know if that positive acceptance has come through in the story or
Oh
not.
yeah. But they got there in a way that felt real to me, where they exhausted all the other they resisted and exhausted all the other possibilities.
Possibilities, yeah.
Yeah, before they finally were like, this is happening, and I just need to make a choice if I just want to be a part of the future or not, or if I want to be left behind. But that actually is a choice. I thought
Yeah,
was an
that's
interesting.
a choice too, yeah.
I thought that was an interesting point to make. I feel like a lot of the times, the idea of being left behind feels like it's something that's done to you, but just in this story, the way it works, it's like it's clear that like you can decide to be left behind or you can decide to be a part of this.
Yeah,
That there's agency.
that's great that that's come across, because that was the was something that that was the vision I wrote it with as well. That I think that's what I would go through.
Right.
If something happens like that, I'll resist till the end, I think.
Yeah. So
Yeah.
women are often centered in your work, from what I've seen, of this. And also I went to your site and looked at what who you're centering in a lot of these other stories. And it's obviously centered in this work since it's told from the perspective of mothers. So can you tell me a little bit about what led you to that choice to center mothers in this story?
Yeah, I think older women in specific, especially, have a certain point of view that I feel is not used enough in narratives and stories. And that's something that I wanted to try with this story. I started writing when I started writing, my first novel was for kids, called Ghost Hunters of Kershia, and it ended up with a 13-year-old boy, like, having an adventure in a mountain town, so to speak, right, in India, and a ghost adventure. And after that, I realized that subconsciously I had chosen to write a story as a younger author from a boy's point of view rather than a girl's point of view, when I'm myself a girl, right? So I was wondering why that happened. And it was so subconscious, and these decisions are taken from what you have read as a person, and seen around you, where men and boys would have a more agency and more wise, so to speak. So these gender biases, they constantly sneak up in your own work. And even though you want to be conscious about it, want to not have those biases, every time I make characters, I think those gender biases and obvious thoughts would come into my world from what I've grown in the patriarchal kind of circles that I was part of. And after that, I consciously tried to, bring in point of views of underrepresented genders, so to speak, and see where that takes me if I consciously choose characters who I have not observed as much maybe in the world, in the hierarchical world that I'm part of. And that's where I started to explore different kind of narratives that would bring me this point of view, really. And I'm happy to think that after years of writing, this is where I am. And even though I grew up in a patriarchal society and I have a tendency to go back to the structures that I've grown up in subconsciously, I am able to take my writing away from that, and stories like this story make me happy that this happened, that this choice happened, because as writers, you never know where the subconscious is taking you, really. And most of the time, sometimes you just echo the systems that you've grown up in. It's very, very hard to break through those systems also. I think it's like this breaking of patriarchy so much that is something that I feel that I've now started to achieve as a writer. And I feel the sense of relief, that maybe I'm questioning and going in the right direction. That's how I want to develop my writing as well in future. I'm not there yet, 100%, but yeah, I'm on my way, definitely.
And has that had a kind of like a rollover effect, like in your just daily life, or when you see, when you're reading stories, do you look at them differently now? Like, have you noticed, I always kind of feel like, okay, well, so imagination is a muscle. So if you're using this muscle and you're kind of going to the gym and it gets stronger and stronger, what happens like out in the world?
Yeah, I'll tell you a story for this. And you're right, it has had that effect. On me also as an individual, because let me tell you the story. It's I grew up in Delhi, which is the capital city of India.
Yeah.
And it was not very safe for women at night, and I grew up, I did my college there, I studied there, I worked as a young journalist there, every time I would go out in the night somewhere or something, my parents would be very, very worried about me. And I've had incidents of, sexual harassment. It was a normal thing for me to deal with them, really.
Yeah.
So when one of my stories that novels that I wrote, like a series of three novels on a character called Anantya Tantrist, and she is a tantric detective based in Delhi, and her job is to solve supernatural crime in city, and that happens only at night, So through my three novels, I walked with her on the same streets that I had grown up a little fearful of, unconscious of my body and where I am, and is there someone behind me or something. I have gone with her on these streets and taken them back, taken those public spaces back through her adventures, because in those stories, I kind of flipped everything that I was scared about. Gender constructs were broken. She's dealing with a stricter patriarchy because she's the only tantric woman, so to speak, who has that agency to solve crime, who can handle magic, so to speak. And she's also standing up against the patriarchy. So it was just such a parallel character for me to live through her. And I think that set me free from my fears in Delhi also. And now that when I visit the city back, I don't live in Delhi anymore. when I visit that city back, and even if it's night or even if it's still as unsafe as it used to be, my reaction to it has changed. I have outgrown that fear that I had built up in myself. And I feel if I didn't realize this when I was writing that it was such, again, such a subconscious decision to do. But I'm very happy because there are a few women who have written back to me to say that the story did the same for them from the beginning. That's brilliant, I think. That's like great to hear that people can change. Fiction changes you, no? We know that's what feels it changes you with the possibilities of it. And I think I want to consciously write that fiction that reading changes the person, the reader. That's the mecca for me, perhaps, to reach in writing.
Yeah, absolutely. That's so inspiring. Thank you for sharing that story. It's very moving.
Thank
You
you.
know, and reflecting on other first, I gotta read those books that you wrote. One, two, I saw that on your website and I was like, supernatural. I was like, that sounds like something I want to read. And it's reflecting on the same thing as well, like spaces of where I too was like, I being there at night, it's dangerous. It's always dangerous in a female body. Like it's always a sundown town. I don't know if you're familiar with that word. Sundown towns are places in the US where if you're there after dark and you're black, something it's open season on you. But I always kind of feel like just walking around in a female body, it's always that. It's always kind of open season on you, whether it's dark or daytime. And so it is interesting to reflect on those spaces and how much, there's only so much you can do about a patriarchal, it's only so much you can do about patriarchy. It's like it's not all on us. Like I get like whole fight the patriarchy, but it's like, but at the end of the day, sexism isn't actually my problem. So it's like actually it's the other group that's got to do something about it. I can only do so much, but I can't control myself and how I feel about it. And it is interesting when you start to think about, what struck me about the story that you just told is that you explored letting go of this fear. And then when you let it go, your experience of the same place changed. So I don't know if complicity is like the wrong word, but like there was permission that was kind of like subconsciously being given. Like you were doing it together in a way, a little bit, like just a tad. And what happens when you stop giving permission? What happens when you approach it differently? Not to say like you can't control other people, and people are gonna just they're gonna do and they're gonna say what they're gonna say, but how you decide to carry that, or if you decide to carry that.
If you decide to, yeah, it's like taking your power back in that sense. And I didn't know this would happen when I was writing that story, but it was amazing to go back to the same streets and I realized I'm not affected by it at all now, in a way. I mean, the catcalls are there, the harassment is still there. You have to become more aggressive on that street to survive it. Yes, that's all there. But it's not emotionally hitting me anymore. Somehow I had developed maybe protection, a magic spell, maybe put a spell around me for fiction. I don't know.
Work you did for young audiences, and I want to touch on that a bit. Like, tell me a bit about what you write for young audience, like what age group specifically, and are you tackling some of these similar themes in that work as well?
So I write fiction, which is speculative to science fiction, horror, fantasy, and I write science. So I write on technology as a journalist, and I write nonfiction as well. And this is for both kids and adults, and the forms range from writing novels or books or comics or short stories, prose in most styles, so to speak. For kids, I've written for ages 9 and above, till young adult. And most of my work, I think, again, without too much of a conscious decision, subconsciously centered around gender and society and caste and how technology or science changes these dynamics, you know, in the worlds that I create or I'm part of. Or another theme that I think emerges strongly in my work, and I would like to explore that more and more, is how we perceive creatures or things or species we call others, who are not us. So us versus them is something that I constantly explore in any work that I'm doing. And I this is especially in speculative fiction, I think it works very well, because be it monsters or aliens or, you know, spaceships or AI or dolphins in this story's case, what happens when people who are, or other religions, I mean, anything, right? What happens, how do we treat other religions? How do we treat other creatures or species or genders? And what does it say about us? I think that's where that tension constantly I kind of bring out in most of the work that I work in, that interests me, so to speak. I've already talked about Anantya Tantrist and how gender inversion was like one of the main themes in that, and the other theme in those series was that there's a very rigid hierarchy of magical power. The people who have the power, who are the tantrics, who are human, they are not the ones who have magic. So magic is with other species who are slaves of those tantrics. So even race and questions of abuse to get that power were like, you know, strong themes within this world that I built. And somewhere Anantya's trying to fight it, or, you know, not fight it also, because she's a bit of a free wall and she's like, I want to stay away from things as well. So I think those were important for me, on us versus them and others, and how they are being treated by the majority, by those in power, those kind of questions. And another interesting book, a young adult novel that I wrote, is called How to Steal a Ghost, which is set in a university.
Wait, How to Steal a Ghost?
So I like to play around with terms and have fun, entertain myself, and write videos through things. That's a 17-year-old young girl who starts in a university town in India, and she becomes a paranormal investigator for a crush that she has on an older guy. And we see her as the narrative, and she's the weakest when the book starts, really, because there are two men in her life. One is a guide who's a 70-year-old retired professor, and one is this guy who's a crush, and he wants her to spy on this guy, and there are ghosts involved and all kinds of stuff happening. But slowly, as the story builds up, as there are like cases that she solves, and she finds a certain knack of becoming, being good at investigating ghosts, so to speak, and various folklores around it, she finds her power. And at the end of the novel, she's the most powerful. And these two men are the ones who are dependent on her for what she's achieved. And I thought that was an interesting way of becoming stronger through this experience, through finding agency, to figuring out your path in a new world, so to speak, as well. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, so and my latest book, I'll be brief about it. I think it's quite a long. We've been chatting for almost an hour already.
No, it's great.
yeah, so I'm hoping I'm not keeping you away from breakfast.
No, no.
And, yeah,
I'm good. I'm
and
good. Please do tell me about your latest book, please.
that's a nonfiction on Indian scientists, and it's for 12 onwards in age group, middle grade onwards, and it's about amazing, wacky inventions and discoveries that have come out of contemporary science in India. So, not very global, so to speak, but very. It was fun for me to do writing nonfiction, which is so different from my speculative fiction worlds, and finding these contemporary scientists and retelling their stories with the same kind of, drama, so to speak. Which I bring in characters that I create, yeah. But in my short stories, I think there are two that I would like to mention as well. One is called Bhaisab's Bespoke Bride's Boutique, which is an Indian family looking for a robotic bride for their son, and
A
it's hilarious.
robotic bride? Okay.
A robot, a custom-made bride, if you will, who has
Okay.
all the,
All the
cute
amenities.
features, which, yeah, with a hard body, yes. I had a good time creating this story, and I thought it was fun to reflect on because it's something that emerges from my society where arranged marriages is still the norm, and people actually talk height and how much are you earning, and what are your plans after marriage? Are you going to have one baby or two baby? And these are families talking, not individuals. Or, are you a virgin or not? And those kind of questions. Yeah. Can you sing or not? Can you cook or not? So yeah, I had a good time thinking that maybe if you want such a customized human, maybe you'll opt for a robot in the future and customize it for yourself. Yeah.
Seriously. That's not crazy to me. I mean, a lot of the AIs, whenever they see, I also love technology and I love the way gender plays out in tech specifically, in these little tiny ways. So even just like that Alexa is Alexa, not Alex, right? That we have these service androids or AI, and it is usually fem gendered most of the time. They're very rare, or it's like neutral, but if it is gonna, but a lot of the times I notice it excuse fem, or it'll be fem presenting.
And they would have the submissive voice and, the soft spoken, always never getting angry, always like, oh, what would you like? How can I help
So a lot of the times
you?
when you see that these like new techs rolling out and like the robotics convention, blah blah blah, they're usually dressed up as a woman, and it's like that's a choice because this is the thing. You really didn't have to give her a wig. Like you didn't. She doesn't. This thing doesn't need pronouns. I don't know what you're doing. So that was intentional, whether people are realizing it or not. So I always. That's why I'm like, this doesn't feel so strange because there are places. I know that there are countries where whatever different policies they had regarding gender and regarding the way they treated their girls, they now don't have enough women in their country. And so folks are exploring, not necessarily a place where you can buy a robot, but they are turning to synthetic female synthetic female something because there's just not enough women. Not so insane. I have to read that one too. Wait, is this available on your website? Like we could just order this. People can just
Oh
order
no,
these stories.
it's open. It's on a webzine called Antonym. I'll send you a link, and you
Okay.
can
Yeah, I'm
publish it
gonna.
for your laptop as well. Yeah.
Yes. I'll put it in the notes for everyone, anybody who's listening. It'll be in the notes, these links of like this is where you can get this stuff. My last question, since we're coming up on our hour here, is why dolphins? Just want to know if there was anything specific about it. It's the dolphins that do the singing and the calling and the
And the
transformation
anthropology,
and the
yeah. I think
empathology.
that emerges from my sheer love, just a prejudice, right? Just prejudice. I adore dolphins. Their groups, their social behavior, the way they communicate with each other underwater, the echolocation or the clicks or the bites or their intelligence. And I see them as a community that kind of supports each other, that cares for each other, and not only for each other, but for the sea. And this is going beyond science. I don't think that has been proven yet or whatever. But I wouldn't rely on human information anyway to
right, what do we know?
Reduce the species, yeah. But I think when I was thinking of which species in the world would think about empathy and create a technology around that, like a collective empathy, so to speak, which is the crux of this story. Dolphins were the ones that immediately popped up in my head. It could be, and I'm a huge Douglas Adams fan, so it could be that subconsciously it's his adage that is, yes, so long and thanks for all the fish, and dolphins are the first ones to leave the planet. It could be that that kind of comes that was the reason that I chose dolphins. Now that I think about it, but yeah.
I adore them. Yeah, I mean, a lot of people say dolphins or cats, right? Like, these are the two that are gonna leave the planet. I wouldn't, in terms of leaving the planet, I wouldn't rely on cats to do empathology. Cats have no empathy.
You're right.
They don't care.
I also wanted an underwater creature, maybe, I think, species, because that's such a mysterious world for landers like humans. Yeah. So I think that underwater element of it and children going underwater was something that would have added serious drama to the story. But anyway, it's all reflective. When I was writing the story, it was always dolphins. Cats were never even considered.
Yeah, no way, no whales, no sea turtles, no dolphins.
No, only dolphins, yes.
Yeah.
Never were considered.
And four it whales, is.
They could have been considered, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like whales have been trying, though.
Yeah,
like they've already been trying. They got their songs, and like we're not really doing it. So
maybe dolphins took credit for whales. Now that I think about it,
well, there's more. I think there's more of one than the other. I mean, I don't know. It made sense to me. I was like, of course, dolphins. But then I just started to wonder, like, why is that so simple? Why am I on board with that? Why? What is that about? Why not anybody else? Why not octopuses, octopi?
Yeah, why not? Yeah, octopi. Yeah, that's a good question. Nice. Yeah,
but they maybe look like aliens. Subconscious.
Yeah, but they're cute. They have like these little suckers and like going all over the place.
I think there's like a fear though. Like people swim. You never hear about anybody like I swam with the octopus. Like no one's trying to scuba dive to do that. They want to swim with dolphins.
Yeah, there was a documentary I did watch about an octopus and a human being friends, and that was a beautiful documentary. I forget the name, but
I think it was just like My Friend the Octopus, wasn't it? Like it was pretty direct.
My friend.
He was just like, this is what this movie is about. I'm not being creative. I'm just gonna tell you, and it's a declarative statement. It's not even a title.
You're right. I think that is what it was. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yes, yeah. I hear you. And you are right that the image of like that part in the story where the children just run into the ocean and disappear on purpose is terrifying. Yeah.
Without anyone knowing why that's happening. Yeah, that's terrifying.
That was a very like horror moment in the story, because I imagine like all these toddlers. It's like it's a nightmare. Like that's a parent's nightmare.
Have
that happen and then just sit, think like my baby drowned.
Yeah, the drowning part, like the death part. Yeah, it's the worst thing.
It's like horrible. And then I think the return is spooky, right? Like you've done the work of like being a parent who the worst has happened, and then they come back. That's just mind-boggling, you know. And then they're different. It's wonderful. Thank you so much for letting us produce and for speaking with me today, for hanging out for an hour and for having us, letting us produce the story. It was wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Vimoto, for this and for giving me this opportunity to chat with you and getting to know you better. It was lovely. I wish you all the best for your podcast.
Thank you for tuning in to our final Fridays. Support Spooky Black Chicks with a tax-deductible contribution through the link in the bio or by leaving a rate and review. You can also tune in next week for The Mountain by your humble host, Wimoto Naoka. The lovely duo from Nightmare on Fear Street will be guest hosting for our favorite month. Can you believe it's gonna be October already? Till next time.